Hi, subscribers, and today we're going to preview the first 10 of the Mix 100 from 100 to 90. And this is Sci-Fi Talk, the podcast on how sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and comics help us explore our humanity. We kick things off with Walking Dead Season 11 at number 100. The choices for the team didn't always align. Starting us off is Kari Payton, who is Ezekiel, followed by Eleanor Matsura, who is Yumiko, and then Callan McAuliffe, who is Alden. Last, and certainly not least, Josh McDermott, who is Eugene.
Well, I'll make it real simple for you. When we read the script, and the script says, get your ass on a bike and ride to who knows where, you think about it for a little bit, you make a couple of phone calls, and then you get your ass on a bike and you ride to who knows where with Eugene. Because that's what Angela told you to do. And I am nothing if not a very good follower of the script. This is how things go in my world.
Okay. But wait a second. Kari Payton.
That's my kind of surface level performing, Kari.
This is, man, you know what? I'm bringing you the real stuff.
Okay. But also, I think that, it's not an accident that, this particular group is Ezekiel, is Yumiko, we pick up Princess on the way, but it's
right.
It wasn't Maggie that was going with Eugene. It wasn't, there were very particular people that did go with Eugene. And I think it's because those characters, and not just, because Angela told us to, even though she did and will do anything that she tells us to do, but, it's because they have nothing left. They were kind of at the end of their, not the end of the road, but the end of sort of their time and their function in their past community. So for Yumiko, she'd just come out of a breakup. She all of her group kind of dispersed and gone off to do other things. And Eugene's going off on this mission. And I was I'll come. I've got nothing to lose. So it was more about a personal motivation. Whereas, I think for Callan's group, Callan, I don't want to speak for you, but the temperature of that mission was a little different. And there's a lot more sort of people with clashing ideas. Whereas with us, we were kind of all on a unified mission to go out and just see what's out there and find something better.
That's true. If you want to talk about it logically, then yes, your answer is probably better.
I am not, if not a logical person, Kari. You know this about me.
Yes.
I think Alden just has a kind of sort of a pious, almost pious loyalty to Maggie because he's still quietly hoping that they're going to screw at some point. So it's a pretty simple dynamic.
Wait, really?
Do you have anything to add?
A pious. I also want to mention that Yumiko, Eugene, and Ezekiel also share like wonderful hair. We've all got long and luxurious hair. I think that the conversation first started, as many conversations do, at the beauty shop, where we decided to take this surgeon. So there you go.
I'll be brief. I think Eleanor kind of touched on it. It's the circumstances surrounding the decisions that were made are wildly different. One of them, certainly in Alden and Maggie's case, involved the death of someone.
Right.
And that was her call. And and Alden was certainly but let me get your number later. Is that what you're saying? But with the other group, they were certainly, the risk of dying is there. And, there are certainly risks, but I think they're all on board. They didn't have different ideas, as Eleanor was saying, And so every scenario, every situation should be talked through. We even saw it at the beginning of the episode where Maggie was talking about, hey, we can go get this food that we have stashed. And everybody talked about it. And some people stayed behind because that was... I kind of equate that decision to what the decision that, Eugene and Yumiko and Ezekiel all had. But to take it to the extreme where I'm going to decide whether or not this person lives to protect these other people, yeah, I get it, like high stakes, but it's not necessarily her call. But there was a, you know, there's a time limit on it. All the, I know I said I was going to be brief and I'm rambling. So I just wanted to point out the differences that I saw in my mind with that. I think that if our group were faced with similar decision making, you know, we might have differences of opinion there.
At number 99 is Brian Usna, talking about tiki horror and its origins.
They were made in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And they're really... they follow this one character, you know, Dr. Romero, and it's weird experiments.
Of course.
With this sap from a tree that happens to be green, by the way, and it can make monsters. And they're very low budget, Philippine productions, but in English. There's some American characters in them. And they, so they're just, in a way, they're really just low budget crazy, but they're just a lot of fun, and it's that Southeast Asian, that Pacific type of feel. And I actually lived in Jakarta for a few years, like in 2007, I think, to 10, and had a company there. We were trying to produce movies in Indonesia. For the world market, but kind of tapping into the kind of weird mythologies and legends and creatures that they have in that part of the world, which are totally different than the European ones that we're used to. A certain version of vampires. It's based on Bram Stoker. We've got Dracula, the Wolfman. We have a very, you know, zombies are the Walking Dead now, the Romero-style zombies. So we have, you know, certain subgenres in our horror movies, but in Asia, they have a whole different kind of pantheon of creatures that are just incredible and just so surprising.
At number 98 is Time Capsule Episode 378. See for Me is an intriguing thriller combining technology and good old-fashioned suspense. It's about a visually impaired woman that cat-sits in a rich woman's house. She discovers an app that gives her a direction of what is in that space using her cell phone camera and a person on the other line for guidance. I spoke to Skylar Davenport, who is visually impaired and plays the lead, that said person, Sophie, and her director, Randall Okita. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Wait Until Dark, a play I saw.
I've been hearing, yep.
That's years ago. But with some nice twists to that too, actually. We'll start with you, Skylar, and certainly Randall, you can chime in, but she has kind of a gray area about her. She's not all necessarily hero or not necessarily bad either.
She's human.
Yeah, she is human. And she's also very angry about what happened to her.
Yeah.
So talk about that aspect of her and how really it informs her character.
So having experienced what losing your vision or your normal vision can do to you, from my personal experience, I leaned more towards depression and feelings of just sadness and loss, but I can see how that could have just as easily gone the other way and turned into anger and bitterness. Thankfully for me, I did not allow that to happen, but it's a trip when something that earth-shakingly different happens to you, and I don't think that there's any one way to handle it. And so Sophie's way of handling it was just one of many, and she's human, like I said. So
yes.
At number 97 is Double Walker, and I spoke to graphic novel writer Michael Conrad and artist Noah Bailey.
So Noah and I, our previous story was similar in the regard that it featured an unreliable narrator. And we love that because we think I think we share the philosophy that in life, everything is told by an unreliable narrator, and we kind of take that for granted. So it's something that we really like to play with in the stories that we tell. We really didn't know the next step until I found myself in the UK and I took a trip very similar to the one that the protagonists in this story take. And I was just so blown away by the natural beauty of the Scottish Highlands. Oh. You know, it's, listeners, if you've never been, do it. It'll change your life. And it certainly changed mine. Beyond that, much like you, a passion for mythology, for fairy tales, and particularly for some of the more grim and bleak ones that have kind of been polished up over the years and presented in a way that has reframed them as positive beings. And as we all know, all beings are on a spectrum morally, and ours is leaning to the darkest end of it.
At number 96 is Motherland Fort Salem, Part 1. And we kick things off with Demetria McKinney, who talks about Raelle and the other women.
I think out of all three of the girls, she sees pieces of her that she's not necessarily able to expose, because that could be taken as weakness, that could be taken advantage of, and there's too much at stake. But with Raelle not having any real agenda, only to be a good person, understanding the loss that she suffered, and understanding that she can go either way, that rebellious nature can be a positive or a negative. And I think that that's something that she was exposed to as a fosterling. Anacostia was an orphan. So I'm betting, we haven't gotten much into her backstory, but I'm betting that she had an opportunity to be that exact same person. And understanding that it took an Alder to take her under her wing, really show her what this was, really show her love, really show her that, you know, you're not alone. And I think that loneliness is something that bonded her with Raelle.
Oh, excellent. You know, there's a scene when they're in training and Raelle and Abigail get into it because of their mothers and their past. She kind of lets them get into it. Why do you think she did that?
She needed to see what power comes in all forms. And it's exposed in a lot of different ways. Some people use their power for bad, which can be in the form of rage. It can be a form of hatred. And she needed to see what those powers would do untouched. You know, she wasn't going to let it go too far, but she needed to see what they knew to tap into. And if that was rage at that moment, okay, how do we show them that just as much power you have in rage, you have in peace, you have in love, you have in vulnerability, you have in wisdom, you have in stillness. So all of this is a learning lesson for each of them, and she's using what they know to get them to learn what they don't.
Jessica Sutton is Tally.
My character that I play, her name's Tally Craven. She's born and raised in a matrifocal town, and for those who don't know what that is, because I didn't know either when I read it, it's a purely female-based led community. And her line, her particular line, has been given a dispensation since her mother's sisters were killed off fighting on the front lines. So she doesn't have to fight, but she ends up volunteering because in the show she really represents the heart, I guess, the truest believer in the cause. She just knows that there's goodness in her and wants to be good and come into her full potential as a woman and as a witch and to serve her country. So she volunteers despite her mother's wishes. And yeah, that's kind of where the show drops into that little introduction of life before Fort Salem. And you'll find that you get these little introductions to all three main characters.
Ashley Nicole Williams is Abigail Bellwether, who has a legacy to live up to.
It's so cool to play that because she has so many layers to her. There's so much depth. I think her source of pressure being her mom and being a bellwether, she also puts pressure on herself. And that's something I as Ashley do. So it's really cool to be able to connect to her in that aspect. You know, she doesn't want to fail, and that's something I don't want to fail as well. So I think just bringing myself to the character was the coolest part, unraveling those layers in her. And I think it just it makes for a great character all around. Yeah.
At number 95 is a Bite episode with Kim Dickens and Jenna Elfman of Fear the Walking Dead.
It's okay. We're just all going to do the best we can. And I remember meeting fans at some of the conventions and mothers coming up to me and saying, thank you for showing what this is like to have a drug addicted son. And they would cry and they'd say, hey, I have a kid that's addicted to drugs right now. And it's not easy. And sometimes I have to be tough, you know? And so I'm just like really proud of us for, you know, showing trauma, because everybody goes through it and you don't always get to see that, you know? And I think art is effective when you can see it and you feel a part of something. And then it's art, you know what I mean? And I think if we were able to reflect sort of sometimes things that were painful or not perfect or not the typical, then that's what I'm proud of.
You know, just as mothers, like motherhood, what motherhood brings out in you, it brings out your best qualities, but it brings out some of like the ugliest parts of your personality too. And especially if you're, you know, like with Nick, you know, when you have a child that's like struggling like that, it's gonna, you can't help but feel you failed as a mother. And that brings out the ugliest side of you, because mothering is all about making sure the future survives. And when the future starts not surviving, it does something to you inherently in your very core as a mother. And I like that they explored all of those sides of mothering, you know, the love, the care, the ugliness, you know,
failing.
Like, yeah.
The times of like, I think like those primitive experiences of motherhood that you don't always see, and I think resonate with people and families. And I thought that was, I was proud of our show for having the courage to sort of do that, shine the light there.
And now on to number 94 with writer Mark Bernadine from Bite.
I got to credit you for working on Star Trek Picard. I just felt the whole Star Trek series on Paramount Plus now has actually grown up a little. Even if you look at the old Next Generation episodes, it was like they were still evolving, but Picard seemed like more of an adult show, really, again, tackling some themes kind of up the level. So, you know, what was your feeling working on that series?
I mean, Star Trek, it's relatively unique in legacy media. And by that, of course, I mean stuff that's been around for like 30, 40, 50 years, in that it goes through these phases of, you know, popularity and omnipresence, and then these fallow periods where the ground kind of gets to renew itself a bit. And so, you know, The Next Generation was itself a show that had been learning from the classic series and from the animated series and from the movies. But even from the beginning of Next Generation to the end of Next Generation, it had evolved and matured and become its own thing, and had found a way to be less hidebound by sort of classic dogma and embrace what it was supposed to be. And I think Star Trek always kind of does that. And the fact that Star Trek gets to show up every 10 or 15 years in a new guise that remembers exactly what it used to be, you know, is it allows it to evolve and mature and metastasize into ways that are new and invigorating. And even, you know, Picard and Discovery and you know, Strange New Worlds, these shows will find their footing. Like, they will start in one way and they will deepen and mature and evolve, and the storytellers will figure out what the rhythms make the most sense for them, and the strength of the actors who are playing the roles, and how these characters can sort of twist into new pretzel shapes. And so working on Picard was both this weird echoing, you know, reverberance from my childhood growing up watching Next Generation, and then the joy of getting to imagine those stories going forward. You know, like, what happens to this character? What happens to that character? How do they, how does their past inform their present to dictate their future? And how do you draw those arcs that connect and make sense to somebody like me who's watched them from the very beginning? So it was a fantastic experience getting to work on the second season and getting to help be part of telling that ongoing story. You know, that's the nerd dream, is to get to be the slightest part of the things you grew up loving. And so, you know, to get to put one note on the staff of that song was pretty great.
What's it like working in kind of a universe where we know the characters, and there's certain things you can do and certain things you can't do because the character, we've seen him on the screen a long, long time.
It is a bit like, you know, playing with somebody else's toys. You know, where like you go to the sandbox and there's a whole mess of toys in the sandbox and you can kind of pick them up and you can do kind of cool stuff with them. And then after a while, like, you realize that you're never going to change these toys. They're always kind of going to be what they are, you know, unless the family who owns the toys decides like, yeah, man, you can rip that leg off. That might be kind of cool. But otherwise, you pick them up, you have adventures, and you put them back so that the next person can pick them up and play again. So there's a freedom in that, which is different from the freedom of making your own stuff up and getting to dictate all of the adventures and how the toys look. But the freedom of, here's a cool thing that I can try and do cool things with, you know, and that's kind of fun, because there have to be some constraints. You know, I think there's some Orson Welles quote that goes something like, the enemy of art is the absence of limitations. And so, you know, the limitations placed upon you by working with somebody else's toys can still yield really fun stuff.
At number 93, I spoke to Misha Collins. And during this interview, we reminisced about wrapping up Supernatural. 15 years for Supernatural. I mean, it's been amazing. It's a show that people would always say, it's not going to make it. And here we are. What's it like working on this last season? And you know it's the last season.
I have to say, it's bittersweet. We have, you know, we've all been working on this show for most of our adult lives, and it has grown to really be a second family for us. So it's going to be really tough to move on. We love, you know, the cast and crew of our show really love working together, and we also have a really amazing dynamic with our fans. It's a once in a lifetime experience, and we all are very cognizant of that fact, and we're loath to give it up. But at the same time, we've been working on it for most of our adult lives, and it feels like it's time for a change. So, It's bittersweet. You know, I'm somebody that, really relishes adventure and new experiences. I took one of those online personality tests recently, and it rated me according to various different criteria, and one of them was values new experiences, and I was at like 98 out of 100 on valuing new experiences. So there's an element of excitement about, you know, doing something new in the future, but there's also a lot of sadness, because we're moving on from something that we know we'll never have again, and that will be very, very special for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, and Castillo had quite an arc. Man, they put you through everything. My favorite, when he was just a regular human guy.
I loved that arc for the character, too. For those who are listening or don't know my character, I play an angel who comes down to Earth and then ends up living with humans at some point along the way. For about a half a season, my character became human, and then he had to figure out what it meant to be human. And it was a fun thing to play with, because he, for example, had never had to brush his teeth before, but then he knew that humans used toothpaste. And so he just emptied a tube of toothpaste into his mouth, trying to figure out how it worked. And there were a lot of those kind of gaffes along the way. I really enjoyed that arc too.
At number 92 is Tim Sheridan, who wrote Batman: The Long Halloween, the two-part animated feature.
We wanted to make this experience feel like the way you felt when you read the book. And yeah, obviously a movie is not a comic book. Right. We experienced those things completely differently. Some things were going, it's called an adaptation for a reason. It's not a direct translation, right? But I will say our goal was to be as faithful and to keep faith with the book as much as we could and still tell a good story as a movie. And so all three of us said that's what we wanted to do at the very beginning. And I think that was our guiding principle throughout. And so when things had to be sort of truncated or trimmed or moved a little bit in terms of where they happen for pacing, those things were easy decisions for everyone, because at the end of the day, we wanted to be faithful not only to the book, but also to our movies. It needed to work as a movie. The good news is we had two movies in order, you know, we had a lot more real estate than we normally have in order to adapt a story. And so that gave us a lot of opportunities to really be faithful to it. Sometimes there are themes that needed to be sort of elevated and given a little bit more weight in order to move the story in a certain direction, but in the direction that it should have, you know, be heading. I've said this before, I'll say this again. The way we, and I write comics now, so there's this is something that's very real to me and palpable to me, which is we experience comic books differently.
Yes.
We fill in a lot of stuff as a comic book reader between panels, between pages, and between issues. We're interacting with the book in a way that we don't necessarily interact with a movie. And so that leads to having to, when you're adapting into a film, you have to make some decisions. What's faithful to the story? What's faithful to the book? What celebrates the book, but is still a satisfying cinematic experience? And that's how we all went into it.
And at number 91 is Sci-Fi Talk Weekly, episode number 63. Deadline has a story with Linda Blair calling her Exorcist director William Friedkin a genius, a maverick, a game changer, and the man who changed my life forever. She posted this on Instagram and added, "Billy Friedkin was a game changer. Thought outside the box, he was a genius with an incredibly bold personality and extraordinary imagery that electrified colleagues and moviegoers alike and remained a true maverick throughout his career in the film industry. He passed away at age 87. One of the things I admired about him, he always wanted to do a backward car chase on the Los Angeles freeway. And he accomplished that in his film To Live and Die in LA. If you've seen that scene, it's absolutely amazing. And he had been planning it for years. Screen Rant reports that songs from Star Trek Strange New Worlds episode Subspace Rhapsody have been topping all the streaming charts. Not unusual, they're great songs. It's number one in the top 100 soundtracks and number three in the top 100 albums. The song, Status Report, has reached number seven on the iTunes song list. Deadline reports that Saw 10, yes, there's going to be another one, is being set in Mexico. Director Kevin Grutter said during a fan Q&A, according to Direct, "There's such a mythology. The city is so amazing. We can't speak enough about it. Not just that, there's a certain creepiness to it and a certain history, and it's absolutely worked for us." The film is set between Saw 1 and Saw 2, as John Kramer goes to Mexico for an experimental cancer treatment, which turns out to be a scam. Oh boy. And finally, at number 90 is Robbie Amell of Code 8, talking about his character, who worked for a drug lord. So it sounds like he's kind of caught in the middle between doing what's right and helping his mom, but also getting the money to help.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the movie is driven by Connor's moral compass and how far he's willing to go to save the most important person in his life. You know, in an early version of the script, we talked about it being Connor's younger brother. And we just thought, you know, with a mom is a little more relatable and easier. Everybody can picture doing something they, you know, probably wouldn't feel comfortable doing normally, if it meant, you know, saving their mom. That, and we'd have to deal with a child actor who can't work as many hours. And we were already up against the gun for getting as much time on as much time out of our money as we possibly could. What I really related to was this guy who's just trying to do the right thing. He's just doing, you know, he's doing bad things for the right reasons. We just wanted to see how far we could push that. And some people at the end of the movie, don't agree with what Connor did, and you know, other people do, which is what we wanted. We wanted it to, you know, we wanted the movie to raise questions and to split people and open up conversations, which we had in the short film. It was really fun to read, you know, the YouTube comments and people, you know, people who were saying that they, you know, they thought he deserved it and other people didn't. And, I mean, that's really what you're hoping for when you make a project.
All right, subscribers, I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for listening. More of the Mix 100 will continue in February. Thanks for listening. I'm Tony Tolotto.